I'm Walter Parker, and it's my pleasure to speak with Studs Terkel, radio host, author, oral historian, about his new book, And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. Studs, this book has been out for how long?
Well, it's been out now about, 4 weeks or so. But I wrote it. It was ready a year ago. All set to publish it. When I walked down the stairs, I tripped. I did a tour jeté, but didn't land on point. And it was choreographed not by Balanchine, but by Bob Fosse. It was jazzy, and suddenly my head hit the siding, and I broke my neck.
Ouch.
So I was in the hospital for 6-7 months, delayed publication of the book. When after 7 weeks in the hospital, Rush Medical Center, Chicago, with surreal dreams, and I don't know if they ever happened or not, my cardiologist tells me that I'm 93 by this time, and he says, your heart valve is on the blink. We'll have to remove your valve and put a new one in. You'll be our oldest customer in that respect. And I said, well, the heck with it. I've done enough. It's enough. But my ego got the best of me. I said, what would the world be like? I'm curious. After I'm gone. So my ego said, okay, let's do it. And so it was the curiosity that did it. And so I have my epitaph all set. Curiosity did not kill this cat.
Well, how is your health now?
Good. As well as could be expected, as the nurse would say.
We know you best as an oral historian, equally at home, speaking with heads of state, great artists, or day laborers. But your long career in radio began with music, didn't it?
I'm known as an oral historian and have a reputation involving the books about war and working and the Great Depression and race for interviewing non-celebrated, that is, ordinary people, so-called, a phrase I dislike because it's patronizing. And it seems pretty well accepted. But at heart, I was a disc jockey. I really was, before the word disc jockey became part of our working vocabulary. And I would play records of all sorts, from a Caruso record to Louis Armstrong doing West End blues, to Woody Guthrie doing a Dust Bowl ballad. And some of these interviews are 40, 50 years ago, but they apply to now, a 20-year-old Bob Dylan telling about his own dream and thoughts. But the idea of eclectic, that's the key word, the variety. And I've always felt that classical music sometimes had hard-working people in awe. They read about it. They read about opening nights and women, Balenciaga gowns and tiaras on their head. They thought it was not for them. I have one case of a working man who was brilliant in everything, but classical music he gave up on. He thought it was not for him, too good for him. So one day it's raining very hard. And to escape the rain, he hops into the corridor of the building, and it's a symphony hall. And he hears from inside a music. And he opens the door slightly, and he hears Mozart. And he listens, and he listens, and he enjoys it, and he feels better, and suddenly realizes, this music is for me, too.
You interview artists from classical, jazz, folk, blues, gospel traditions for this book, and they all sang Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. But you mentioned Caruso in your introduction. You tell of your father bringing home recordings of Caruso, and you refer to Caruso as your first personal hero and liberator. How is that?
I'm so delighted you asked that question. Caruso is the unsung hero of this book, though I have a couple of divas, old-time singers, who worked with him. And they speak of his generosity of spirit. They speak of his being scared every first night. I says, you, Signor Caruso, says this young singer, Rosa Raisa, for whom Puccini wrote the opera Turandot. He never finished it. And so she says, why are you nervous? He says, people wanted me 100%. I want to give 108%. And Caruso, old immigrants, 1903, 1905, came here, Italian, Jewish, all variety. and they'd buy a Caruso record. They have little money. They made very little dough. But a Caruso record was $2, come to $100 today. They'd buy O Paradiso from L'African or Celeste Aida, and they'd hear that voice. And I remember my mother being furious at my father for spending $2 for a record. All he said was, Caruso. And she was quiet. Because he did something to people. The poet John Chardy says he was Italian family from Providence, Rhode Island. His uncle would play that record again and again, and his uncle felt uplifted. And Chardy said, what Caruso did with his talent, over and beyond what was expected, is what ordinary people are capable of doing and feeling. So it's more than about music. It's about the possibilities in people who think their lives aren't worth talking about. Well, they've been my heroes, as you know, in the other books. And here there are gifted musicians who are, I treat the same way. That is, I act with them the same way. So that was Enrico Caruso. And I followed that Caruso record. Let's say it's an aria from the oratorio of Handel, Xerxes. It's a wonderful aria, Ombre Ma Fu. It's one of these beautiful things. I followed that with Louis Armstrong's West End Blues, my favorite of all jazz records, with the Hot Seven, Earl Hines at the piano, exploring, and Louis and his horn and voice one. And with that, I'd follow Woody Guthrie, say, doing Dust Bowl Ballads, or interview with Bob Dylan 40 years ago when he's 20 years old. So that was the kind of program it was, eclectic.
Now, opera and opera singers play a prominent role in the book. Has opera been a special love of yours, or is it just part of your overall fascination with the human voice?
But that's the whole thing. I call that vox humana, the human voice. And these may be singers young people have never heard about, but they were 40 years ago. Tito Gobbi, for example, at the Lyric Opera in Chicago, whom I got to know, was the great Scarpia Vade. Scarpia is the villainous police chief in the opera Tosca. John Vickers, who is the great Heldon tenor, Wagnerian tenor of our day, is the great Tristan, Tristan and Isolde. He hated Tristan and Isolde. The challenge was the aria itself. But Tristan and Isolde, terrible people. I wouldn't want to live next door to him. But nonetheless, he would speak of opera. And in fact, there's one called Peter Grimes by Benjamin Britten. It's about an outsider, how the community regards an outsider, someone who is different, and they want to kill him. And it's a remarkable study in human. Then there's Andre Segovia, the great guitarist, and he's this 85-year-old virtuoso who made the classical guitar taken seriously. And he's playing before 5,000 people, say, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And he delicate guitar, and one of his fans comes up to the end and says, Maestro, you're wonderful, but you played so softly. I had to lean forward and listen intently. And Segovia said to me, do you know what I did the next time? I played even more softly. And then I'd go into the jazz sequence about Louis Armstrong's discovery of the richness of his heritage when he was in Ghana in West Africa. And then there's Gillespie, telling about his adventures in the Middle East, the troublesome area where he was lifted on the shoulders of all the young people in the midst of crisis because they respected jazz and this American artist. And then we go to folk song and to blues and spirituals and Mahalia Jackson. So that's the book. They're all related. And I always feel that people have the capacity to appreciate all sorts of music. And they could tell the good from the bad if they have the good often enough.
Well, you've interviewed these great artists from all these various fields of music. Do you find common threads in their attitudes toward their art, toward music and their craft?
Continuously. That's a good question. Their art and their life are related. And we hear this often. Who are these celebrated people who dare express political opinions? You mean they're deprived of their rights because they're gifted? Is that what we're saying? You could say to ordinary people, you're not known. Who gave you the right? I thought the whole idea of a democracy is to connect your life and your art and your work as one. And to be silent is not to be a good citizen. On the contrary. So to deny these people the right to express their opinions as they do is to deny your own right to express your opinion. So in a way, it's related to music and life outside. It's connected. Music, of course, is the great connecting link. I'll never forget John Donahue. He was a priest who was head of the Coalition of the Homeless in Chicago. His father was an old firefighter, years, all his life. And his one regret, as he was dying, he told his son, "My one regret is not telling my buddies at the firehouse that I loved opera." See? As though it was too good for them. It wasn't. That's the whole point. Leonard Bernstein, who's in it, by the way, as a composer, who has a generosity of spirit, even sings some songs from other people other than himself. And I sang with him because I was in one of those plays he was talking about during the WPA days.
That's right. He refers to Mark Blitstein's The Cradle Will Rock.
The Cradle Will Rock. Now, I don't know if listeners know The Cradle Will Rock. It was a movie made by Tim Robbins. Cradle Will Rock came out of the Work Project Administration of the New Deal during the Great Depression. The government came through when private enterprise fell on its fanny. And the headline of Variety, the trade paper, was Wall Street Lays an Egg. And they pleaded with the government, please help us out. And the government did, provided jobs for guys with the shovel and the pick, but also for the artists and theater people and musical people. And the most controversial theater spread was Cradle of Rock. And I was in a Chicago company. And when Leonard Bernstein heard that, he sang some songs from it. And I joined him. We were both terrible singers, but it was a wonderful song. I remember one lyric. It's from a town that's owned by a guy, a steel town, and opens with a girl who becomes a hooker out of necessity. And she sings a song, because sometimes you wonder what it is makes people good or bad. Why some guy, an ace without a doubt, turns out to be a bastard and the other way about. I'll tell you what it is. It's the nickel under the foot, meaning having something. Well, he was wonderful. He joins in it, and he talks about the need for art and life to be related.
That's Leonard Bernstein. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you briefly also about, though, the other composers you have here who are very distinguished and prominent, Virgil Thompson and Aaron Copland.
Well, Aaron Copland, of course, went deep, deep into American folk song and composed his own work out of it. And Virgil Thompson was a witty, very witty and brilliant critic who became a composer. What's interesting, we heard about the catastrophe in the Gulf cities in New Orleans and the government not prepared for it all because all the dough is going to fight Iraq, all the dough is going to the Pentagon, and no dough for health and education and welfare and catastrophe. Well, during the New Deal, Virgil Thompson did music for a couple of movies put out by the Department of Agriculture, Farm Security Administration, in which they prepared for the floods, and they prepared and they stopped floods from happening ahead of time because the government cared for the people. And out of that came Tennessee Valley Authority. They prepared for the Dust Bowl, not at first, but later on. And Virgil Thompson did music for that. And so you see, the connection between life and art is one. And so I hope people like the book. I'm treating these artists, or I behave toward them, the same way as I do toward the people who are not as celebrated. Those who are celebrities because they're celebrities are a dull lot. I find they as dull as the people who interview them. I don't want to go into it. You can name anyone. You know what's going to be forthcoming, plugging whatever they're doing, and nothing connected with you or your life. Whereas these artists I'm talking about have something else, their own giftedness, but they see the connection of themselves and the world outside.
And that reminds me of your conversation with pianist Garrick Olson, who won the Warsaw Chopin competition in 1970 and continued to return to Poland.
Well, I'm so delighted you brought him up. He's little known for people. Now, Gary, this guy won in Warsaw. The American wins the Chopin competition several years after Van Cliburn won the Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow during the Cold War. Now, we all remember Van Cliburn, even young people might, because there was a ticker tape parade when he returned, bigger than Lindbergh had. But the trouble, Van Cliburn's a wonderful pianist, but he stuck to Tchaikovsky, because that's what they wanted all the time. Whereas Gary, they himself, was even, he says, I will not be a Chopin-zee, meaning he admired Chopin very much, and explains him as never before. They wasn't just light-hearted and something gentle and soft. He was strong, and he analyzed them. He said the trouble with Van Cliburn is they made him too much of a celebrated hero, and therefore they hampered his growth. And it's very moving. It's a tribute to Van Cliburn, but more than that, a tribute to all those who seek out new territory. For example, he would also talk about the great artists. Was classical music ever improvised? It was full of improvisation. Bach improvised a great deal. In fact, you listen to the modern jazz quartet, jazz group who's wonderful. They have a Bach album of Bach, and they do a jazz version of Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring that knocks you for a loop. And I know that Johann Sebastian Bach would have loved it, because that's what it's about. They wrote for everybody, not just for their sponsors. So that's what the book is about, really. It's a continuation of the others. In this case, they are musical artists.
Well, considering how important a part of your life music has always been, why did you wait so long to do one on music?
I don't know. Well, I was thinking about this a long time, but something else came up. The subject of race comes up. The subject of growing old. And what is the most horrible and all-encompassing of all isms? Ageism. We know what's happening, this crazy world of ours. We've expanded life, right? I'm 93. I should be dead because my father and two brothers died of angina in their 50s. I had angina. But along came this new machinery and skilled hands and advances. And so when I was a kid, I was home because I had asthma. I was a sickly kid, asthma. What's that called again? Mastoiditis. Many small boys had mastoiditis in the days before penicillin. Today I find kids going down the street holding their ears. I said, oh, my God, it's a recurrence of mastoiditis. You know what it was? Cell phone. They got the cell phones in their ears. And I always think the cell phone is they're holding their ear because of mastoiditis. And so here I am. I'm not quite a member of the 21st century. I'm of the 20th century. For example, hardware and software to me. Hardware is a kettle. It's a pot, a pan, metallic knife, a fork. Software is a pillowcase, is a bedspread, is a sheet. So that's where I am in the world of the computer. I'm a Neanderthal in that respect.
Well, let me ask you one more question, if I may, Studs. Is there a prominent musician that you always admired that you were never quite able to get into the studio that you wish you had had a chance to interview?
Well, of course, Caruso. I never heard Caruso in person. Oh, God. These two singers, Edith Mason and Rosalie, by the way, little known, they're both great divas of their day, and they both worked with Caruso as they were young singers. And they spoke of his, he's the one who established the phonograph, the Victrola. It was his voice that carried that company and made it come to life. You know, the one the little dog is listening, and that's a horn, his master's voice. That's all Caruso's work, people buying his records. So, oh, he's the one, of course, I would love to have heard. I never saw her Toscanini conduct of course, that would be. But if I were to name one, there is no one person. But if I were to name the one, I would say Caruso. It's a magic word, like when you speak of the human voice, Caruso. When you speak of the certain, there's a word called eponymous, a word I've always wanted to use. I can use it, and I like synonymous. Caruso's name is eponymous with singing, just as baseball. What's the name you think of? Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth, baseball. Early movies, Charlie Chaplin. And then voice, Enrico Caruso.
Well, Studs, it's a remarkable roster of people that you've interviewed in this book. The book is And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, with artists from the classical world, the jazz world, the folk music world, and impresario Saul Hurock is in here. It's a remarkable book. I congratulate you, Studs.
Oh, thank you, Waterford. You ask my favorite questions. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Studs Terkel, our guest today.
Thank you.